So it's a great pleasure to have Daniela Alves here with us. Daniela got her PhD from Stanford University in 2011, and now she's a scientist at Los Alamos. And she'll be telling us about quasi-stellar neutrinos. So whenever you're ready, Daniela.
Okay, thanks, Mateus. Thanks for the invitation. I'm sorry I cannot be there in person, but hopefully in the future I'll be able to visit the PI. Okay, so my talk is about this recent archive preprint that came out in early January in collaboration with Bill Lewis and Patrick Denerville. They're both here at LANL. And I'll also, towards the second half of my talk, I'll talk a little bit about work in progress. So the motivation for this paper was the mini-Boone low energy axis. So just to put this into context, for those who are not super familiar, the mini-Boone experiment was built primarily to try to confirm or disprove an axis that was observed on a predecessor experiment that was LSND. And LSND saw an axis of nu mu bar to nu e bar oscillations that could be explained pretty well with a model with a sterile neutrino. That's usually called the 3+1 sterile neutrino model. So three active neutrinos, one sterile neutrino. And so if you take a typical model that explains well the LSND axis and you look at the prediction of this model at mini-Boone, what you would expect, you know, it's just a benchmark, is something shown here in this plot. So here's true neutrino energy versus oscillation probability for nu mu to nu e at mini-Boone. And what you expect for such a 3+1 model at mini-Boone is something like this shaded yellow region. And what mini-Boone saw over the years with accumulated data and better statistics and understanding of backgrounds were these red points with error bars. Okay, now one interesting thing is that mini-Boone seems to confirm the LSND axis, at least in this mid to high energy range above about 400 MeV. Now, the intriguing thing is that mini-Boone also saw a much larger axis in this low energy region below 400 MeV that is very hard to fit with the 3+1 sterile neutrino model, especially if you want to also fit the LSND axis. Okay, so in light of the situation, there are many attitudes that we observe amongst our colleagues. Some just tend to dismiss completely this entire mini-Boone axis as some unaccounted systematic effects or backgrounds. Others who are fans of the 3+1 sterile neutrino models, they tend to dismiss only the low energy part as some systematics or backgrounds, but take more seriously the mid to high energy part as a confirmation of sterile neutrinos. But the approach that Bill and I and Patrick took on this paper was just to ask ourselves the question, what if this is indeed a genuine BSM signal? And what could it be? And we're not the only ones to ask this question. There has been a lot of activity in the recently in the community in trying to explain this low energy axis, not through nu mu to nu e oscillations, but instead as some light dark sector signature of some new particle being produced in the mini-Boone detector that is mimicking a nu e charge current scattering event. That's not the question we asked. The question we asked in this paper was, could we explain this axis as a genuine BSM signal from oscillations, so nu mu to nu e appearance? And this is basically the final answer that we found in the paper. We attempted to explain this low energy axis through resonant neutrino oscillations. So these resonant oscillations, they come within a very narrow window of energy, and they spike up very sharply to very large oscillation probability, and then they go away as you increase the energy. So these resonant oscillations, they enter only to explain the low energy axis in this lower energy bins. Of course, these oscillations get smeared. And then in the higher energies, we need a standard 3+1 model to explain the rest of the mini-Boone axis and also to be compatible with LSND and other experiments. And so this is one benchmark that we considered. And if you take this oscillation probability at truth level and you make it go through the analysis pipeline of mini-Boone to get an event axis, you get that this is the result. This is the event rate at Mini Boon, and you see that this is very consistent with the Moon data, Mini Boon data, and so it's an excellent fit.
Oh, Daniela? Okay, so
yes.
So what do you mean when you say high energy excess? Because I see that the data, you know, kind of fluctuates. So.
Oh, but by high energy axis, I just mean to distinguish from the low energy axis, which is this region below 300 to 400 MeV. So high energy, I mean like, you know, high energy. But you're right that the axis is not as significant here in the higher energy bins, although note that there is a, these bins are all very much correlated. So, but yeah, did I understand correctly your question?
I see. So you were referring to the plot to the right then.
Sure. So yes. This plot on the left is it's a heuristic plot because these points here, they assume that the true neutrino energy is the same as the reconstructed quasi-elastic scattering energy. This is a very rough approximation. So this is just to make a point. Don't take this very seriously. What Mini Boon actually observed was this, and this is how this resonant model explains this data.
I see. So then excess, you mean like around 500 and 700, those bins?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay.
But also, yeah, no, I mean, if we only had Mini Boon and no other data, then we will be tempted to dismiss this excess here. But then we have LSMD, who actually prefers models that will lead to an excess in this range. So it's not just Mini Boon, there's also LSMD.
Okay.
If you want to explain LSMD and not dismiss it altogether.
I see. Thank you.
And this is neutrino data or anti-neutrino data?
Neutrino data, yeah. Okay. In anti-neutrinos, the low energy axis is not as significant. You know, a 3+1 stereo model can fit pretty well the anti-neutrino data. Maybe on my next slide. So the rest of my talk is everything in between. So how do we build this model? So, you know, one way to think about inducing these resonant oscillations is going to a framework where you have a dark sector. So if you have a generic dark sector, you expect to have matter in this dark sector, so dark sector fermions. And you also expect that there will be new forces in the dark sector. So, for example, vector gauge bosons that will couple to this dark sector matter. Now you have ultraviolet physics and radiative effects that will very generically mix some of these dark sector fermions with the active neutrinos of the standard model. And so by definition, then these dark sector fermions will be sterile neutrinos. And this is called a neutrino portal. And you also have very generically would expect that these forces in the dark sector will develop some very tiny couplings with ordinary standard model matter. And this is the vector portal. Now, if you take these two very generic things from a dark sector, which is a neutrino portal and a vector portal, and you put them together, like in this cartoon, you see that a very generic thing happens that the sterile neutrinos are no longer fully sterile. It's better to characterize them as quasi-sterile because they can couple to standard model matter very feebly. And another generic thing is that now that it can couple to standard model matter very feebly, it can experience a matter potential once these neutrinos are propagating through finite to medium density. And this matter potential, of course, depends on the mass and couplings of this vector mediator and on the density of the medium.
So now what kind of mediator do you think it can be? Because dark photon cannot be that, right?
That's right. So in this paper we didn't address that. We just
what do you think?
I guess you're going to say whatever I tell you that is not a dark photon might have anomalies that you have to worry about, and then
no, don't anticipate my next move. Just tell me what you think.
I don't know. I haven't thought about it, Maxime. In this paper, we didn't really build a completion to this mediator, but you're right. It has to be a mediator that couples to a combination of electrons, protons, and neutrons in such a way that matter has an average non-zero charge density.
I was just wondering if you had some example in mind that I do not know of, but that doesn't seem to be okay.
No,
maybe
I don't.
Maybe it exists, so yes.
Or maybe it doesn't. Likely it doesn't. But I'll mention a little bit about this later in my talk, but Yeah, but just in principle, if you could have a matter potential such as this, and that's the approach that we took, with the right value, so we could explain the mini-boom axis, what are the consequences?
So to go back to the question, do you need the coupling to quarks, or is the coupling to the electron enough?
If all you're looking at is you want a matter potential, then yes, you can have a coupling just to electrons. Now the question is, once you find a mediator with the couplings and mass that you need to explain the mini-boom, then is that ruled out by something else? And we didn't study any of that.
Because in principle, one can use these lepton number differences to do that, but I guess the constraints are very brutal.
Although keep in mind that, in principle, you can have a very light mediator and tiny, tiny, tiny couplings. So you can try to avoid, all the constraints by making this arbitrarily small, but still keeping this ratio finite, right? A ratio of a very small number of another very small number can be large enough to give you the effect that you need. But again, I didn't explore this in detail, so I'm sorry, I don't have anything more.
No, it's fine. But I guess all of the constraints that I can think of in that case are coming from neutrinos also.
Right.
So the question is, what is more sensitive?
Right. Although keep in mind that this mediator has a small coupling to neutrinos because of this mixing, but the matter potential is mostly experienced by the sterile neutrino. Not the active neutrino. So it's a little different than other models where you have, those non-standard interactions of active neutrinos experiencing a matter potential. Yeah. Okay. All right. So this is a well-known fact. Once you have such a scenario, then you can have resonant oscillations between the active and the sterile neutrino, if the energy and the matter potential satisfy this relation here, given by this expression. And so this is illustrated here in this plot. So this plot shows neutrino energy in units of the resonant energy, as given by this expression. And the curves are the mixing angles in matter for neutrinos in red and for antineutrinos in blue. And there are three curves because they show three examples of the vacuum mixing angle between this active and dark sector fermion. And so these curves are not the same for neutrinos and antineutrinos because the matter potential experienced by them has the opposite sign. And so here, of course, I chose the sign such that neutrinos experience these resonant oscillations, but the antineutrinos do not. So neutrinos start a very low energy with the vacuum mixing angle, and as the energy is increased and they approach the resonant energy, they have maximal mixing with the sterile neutrino. So that's a mixing angle of pi over 4. And then as you continue to increase the energy, this mixing angle continues to increase until it flattens asymptotically to pi over 2, which is again the no mixing limit. And the antineutrinos do not experience this resonant effect. So they start with the vacuum mixing angle at low energies. And as you increase the energy, the mixing angle in matter decreases monotonically. Okay, so that's basically the picture as far as mixing is concerned. So let me show you a cartoon now for what happens with the propagation eigenstates and their eigenvalues. I'm going to first describe a toy model. So this toy model is no good for explaining mini-boom, but it's simpler, it has less moving parts, but it retains a lot of the interesting effects that I want to illustrate. So consider in this toy model, the three active neutrinos of the standard model in green, red, and blue, and then one quasi-sterile neutrino species, okay? And this quasi-sterile neutrino will mix here in this toy model. I chose it to mix with nu3, which is one of the mass eigenstates in the standard model. Now, at low energies, this is the spectrum that you have, which is also the spectrum in vacuum. But these propagation eigenstates, they evolve with increasing neutrino energy. So in particular, at the resonant energy, you have that these two propagation eigenstates have an equal composition of active and quasi-sterile states. And at higher energies, they asymptote to the no mixing limit again, but as you can see, they flip their flavor composition. So the propagation eigenstate with the largest eigenvalue now becomes almost completely active, and the propagation eigenstate with the lowest eigenvalue becomes almost completely sterile. So you see there is this deformation of the active neutrino spectrum because of this matter potential and this mixing with this quasi-sterile neutrino. And you would think that nothing happens in the anti-neutrino sector because anti-neutrinos don't experience these resonant effects, but that's not true. The anti-neutrinos, even though they don't experience this resonant mixing, they also have their spectrum deformed, even though it's in a different way than the neutrinos. But in the asymptotically low energy limit and the asymptotically high energy limit, they also get their spectrum changed in the same way as the neutrinos. And one obvious thing that you might be noticing here is that nu3 in this case, which has experienced this resonant effect, got an effective contribution to its mass squared that is controlled by this combination of parameters. So this is the sine squared of the vacuum mixing angle between the active and sterile states, times the mass squared splitting between the active and sterile states. Now you see, if this is a generic value that you don't bother to tune, then obviously this is very problematic because that means that when propagating in medium and high energies, you have a completely different active neutrino mass spectrum than what you expect in the standard model. And so this is not good. So you have to tune this combination of parameters so that in the high energy limit, you can asymptote back to the standard model scenario. And in this particular toy model, the tuning that you need is for this shift to be given by twice the atmospheric mass splitting, okay? So that you can have in this particular toy model an inverted hierarchy at low energies and a normal hierarchy at high energies. And by imposing this constraint, what you're doing is making this resonant region very, very narrow. Okay, how narrow? This is illustrated here on this plot. So I'm back to neutrino energy versus appearance probability at mini boom. And I'm showing this resonant peak that is very narrow for different values of this vacuum mixing angle. And these values are decreasing from left to right. So two things to note about this is that the width of this narrow resonance peak is nearly independent of the value of this vacuum mixing angle. And it increases as you decrease the vacuum mixing angle. So the peak grows and grows and grows, but only up to a certain point. So once you reach a critical value for this vacuum mixing angle, the resonance peak saturates at a maximum value that in this toy model is given by this expression. And then as you continue to decrease this vacuum mixing angle below this critical value, the peak no longer increases, it's saturated, and you just get very rapid oscillations within this resonance peak that are so rapid that it's even difficult to see in this log scale plot here. But this is what happens. And of course, now you see why this toy model is really bad for addressing the mini boom axis. So one, the peak is not sharp and tall enough to explain the low energy axis. And it's too narrow, so it also doesn't account for the new Newtonian oscillations outside of this resonant region at higher energies. These things you can try to address by adding more stuff to the model. Now, there is another problem that I think is serious, and it's the issue that others encountered as they tried to build these resonant type of oscillations to explain mini boom. And this other problem is this. Like I mentioned, the active neutrino mass spectrum relaxes to the standard model limit at very high energies, but this relaxation doesn't happen fast enough. And so in this toy model, I show the effective atmospheric mass splitting as a function of neutrino energy for neutrinos in orange and antineutrinos in green. And even though they're asymptoting the expected standard model value at very high energies, they take a while to get there, and they don't, they're too slow to do this relaxation. And so they're clearly incompatible with the terminations of this atmospheric mass splitting from long baseline experiments, such as T2K, NOVA, and MINOS. So this is the significant issue with this type of attempts to do these resonance models that others have tried in the past to address the mini-boom low energy axis. Now,
so what, can I just try to understand the role of your mixing angle, theta, I forget what you called it, theta nu s?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So the larger that theta, the broader your peak.
Not really. It's not, yeah, it's not very, I mean, okay. Here's the thing. If you don't constrain the mass splitting, right? If you fix the mass splitting and you start varying theta, that's what you're going to find. That the larger theta, the broader the peak, as I showed here. But you see here, I had to impose this constraint. So if I modify theta, I also have to modify the mass splitting. And because of this constraint that I'm imposing by hand, you know, the behavior of this peak is different. You can play with the values of theta, the width of, you can't really broaden this peak because of that constraint that I imposed.
Okay.
So what you can do is make it taller, but only up to a certain point. After that certain point of saturation, you cannot increase the peak any longer.
But that certain point depends on this product that you're showing there. But if I go to a different flavor transition, then it's, I guess, the analogous elements or
indeed. Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. So that's how we improved this toy model to actually get a larger oscillation probability. So that's my next slide.
Just before you go, I was trying to understand the size of your mass splitting. So your typical masses for this new state are going to be like a couple, maybe one or two orders of magnitude above the light neutrinos. Is that it?
Yeah. So yeah, typically once you impose this constraint, you get this mass splitting to be of order tens of EV, not squared. Sorry. If you squared it, then it's hundreds of EV squared. But
got it. Yeah. Okay, cool. Thanks.
Okay, sure. All right. So like Matheus anticipated, you know, one thing that you can do is have a participation of all of the three active neutrino species so that you can get this resonant peak to be significantly higher. And then you can get enough appearance probability to explain the data here in this low energy bins. Of course, all of this gets smeared out after nuclear effects and detector resolution. And so that's what we did. We invoked this triple resonance model. So we augmented the quasi-sterile sector. Now, instead of one quasi-sterile neutrino, we have three. Each one of the three mixes with one active neutrino. But still, we're constrained with having this resonance region to being very narrow. We cannot make it broad. And so we invoke another vanilla sterile neutrino then to explain the data in the higher energy bins, and also to explain the nu mu bar to nu e bar oscillations at LS&D. And if you want, you know, anti-electron neutrino disappearance anomalies like the gallium anomalies and so on and so forth. So we have a resonant component, a non-resonant component. They are nearly independent. They don't really interfere very much with each other. So you can tune their parameters independently to deal with the different data that you need. So what happens now with the spectrum? It's a lot more complicated. So here are the propagation eigenstates. So we still have the active neutrinos of the standard model, but now we have three quasi-sterile neutrinos. So we have three resonances, one for each pair of active and quasi-sterile friends. And then we have this extra sterile neutrino that is a vanilla one that doesn't participate in this resonant mechanism because it doesn't experience matter potential. And now what we have to do with this model is to tune the parameters so that this shift in the mass of the active neutrinos from below the resonance to above the resonance preserves the spectrum, the mass splitting. So you don't distort, you don't deform the spectrum. And the similar situation happens for antineutrinos in the asymptotically low and high energy limits. You get the same situation as for the active neutrinos. And like I said, it's important that the three resonant regions are close together to avoid these large distortions in the active mass spectrum. That was a problem for the toy model that I presented. And so if you make these guys sufficiently close, and we quantify in the paper what I mean by sufficiently close, you can explain the mini-boom data, and you don't run into this issue with the long baseline experiments. And that's illustrated here on this plot. So I show neutrino energy and mass splittings of the active neutrinos in this model normalized to the expectation in the standard model as given by the central values in the PDG. So you know, when these lines are close to one, that's where you are in the standard model limit. Okay, and I show different mass splitting. So orange is atmospheric mass splitting for neutrinos. Green is atmospheric mass splitting for antineutrinos. And purple is the solar mass splitting for antineutrinos. And there are different experiments that have measured those quantities in different energy ranges. And you see that within the ranges that they probed, the predictions from this model are consistent with these measurements. This dotted regions of these curves are energy ranges that have not been probed experimentally, but they show significant deviation from the standard model expectation. So one experiment that actually probed this region is Mini-Boon, and that's why in this model we have the large axis. But if there are other experiments that could potentially probe this energy region, they could easily exclude this model because of the significant departure from the standard model spectrum. Okay, so that's the main thing that this model addresses that previous models didn't address, is this compatibility with these long baseline experiments. Now there's one more thing that, yes.
Yeah, sorry, just sorry to interrupt again, but
no worries. Mm-hmm.
In the middle there, you have, because your effect is purely as a function of neutrino energy. So the resonance is at a given neutrino energy. So that's kind of different from the L over E for the oscillations. So if I pick an experiment that has the wrong L over E, that typically doesn't constrain the oscillations, but it has the right energy, then in principle, I can also set a limit or find something here, right?
I'm not sure I understand your question. So T2K, see, T2K, in principle, it measures neutrino energies as low as 200 MeV, but it doesn't have sufficient statistics nor resolution in that range. If it did, then it would see a significant departure from the standard model expectation because this mass squared is shooting up. So I guess I have a really bad backup slide that doesn't look nice and polished, but just so you can see. So, okay. Let's focus, for example, on this. Okay, this green. So the green is like one benchmark quasi-stereo model, and this is the prediction for new mu survival of T2K. And the standard model expectation is this dashed gray curve. I don't know if you can see them well, but you see they differ, right? So for the quasi-stereo, because there the active mass splitting is very large, you have very rapid oscillations in this lowest energy bin for T2K. They average out to a half, which is kind of the same averaging out for the standard model expectation. So T2K cannot tell these two things apart. They are very different, but T2K doesn't have the resolution there, right? If you have a more significant deviation in the higher energy range, then T2K could potentially differentiate these two models, but that's the point. This model quickly relaxes to the standard model expectation as you go to higher energies. I don't know if I...
Yeah, no, that was exactly my question. Okay. And the other thing, I guess, is that you could do a Mini-Boon measurement in T2K at the near detector, right? So I don't need to... So the data point that you're showing there is the long baseline measurement, but in principle, yes. I can also do an appearance search in the near detector, right? Does that...
Yes, from talking to Bill, my understanding is that T2K just doesn't have enough statistics in the near detector to be able to either confirm or exclude the Mini-Boon axis. If it did, then I guess everybody would be excited about that.
Yeah, I get that argument, but also the oscillation is L over E, but here it's just the energy. And the L over E for T2K is different from the L over E at Mini-Boon. So typically, if you're trying to, you know, cross-check whether Mini-Boon was correct, people will do it in this oscillation model. But here, yeah, maybe the energies are a bit higher in T2K, but that's kind of surprising a little because both fluxes are 800 MeV at the peak. So yeah, it's something to check actually.
Yeah. But you see, these are slightly different effects. There is the effect of the resonant oscillations that are induced because of, you know, the participation of the quasi-sterile state here. So, you know, in a very simplistic way, you can think of nu mu going to nu sterile, going to nu e. So this is the type of oscillation that is taking place at Mini-Boon. So that's one thing. The other thing is the distortion of the active neutrino spectrum. You know, this resonant oscillations where you have the active participation of the quasi-stellar neutrino, they go away. They go away very fast.
But then I can drop the active neutrinos and just like whatever you do for that resonance in miniboom, I can think of doing the same for theta k. That was my only point. Yeah.
No, yeah, that's right. And this resonance would appear at T2K around 200 MeV. Mm-hmm. So at miniboom, it's 300 and at T2K is 200 because the matter density along the T2K baseline is a little different than the matter density along the miniboom beam line. So that's why, and the, you know, the resonant energy depends on the matter, on the medium density. Mm-hmm. So it's a little different for T2K and miniboom, but T2K in principle would see these resonant effects around 200 MeV, but that's right at the threshold where T2K starts to have sensitivity and it's not great. So that's the thing with T2K. It's just, it's almost there, but not quite, at least not with the current data and sensitivity that they have.
Yeah, thanks. That's very interesting. Thank you.
All right. Okay. So now microboom, right? I just want to comment on microboom. And for that, I will introduce two benchmarks just for illustration for this quasi-sterile model. So for lack of imagination, I call this benchmarks B1 and B2. B1 is the benchmark that I've been showing since the beginning of my talk. It has this probability for nu mu to nu e oscillations at truth level and mini boom that translates into this event rate and mini boom for nu e-like events. And B2 is just a more modest benchmark where we don't saturate the appearance probability at the resonant peak here, but it still provides a good fit to the mini boom data, even though the axis at lower energies is more modest. Okay, so what happens with these two benchmarks at microboom? So let me first remind you that the microboom analysis didn't really attempt to develop a model to explain the miniboom axis. What they did was to develop an empirical LEE model, they call it, which was just an ad hoc flux of VSM neutrinos that were just going through the miniboom and microboom detectors. And this BSM flux was given in units of the intrinsic nu e flux from the booster neutrino beam. So this is the quantification of the flux for the empirical LEE model given by this red hatched histogram as a function of true neutrino energy, right? So it has this shape. Now, the shape of these quasi-sterile benchmarks B1 and B2, when given in this units of intrinsic nu e, are significantly different. As you can see, the shape is like qualitatively different. And yet these benchmarks B1 and B2, like I showed in my previous slide, also provide a good fit to the miniboom data. And this is a point that others have made, including Matheus himself in another paper that he wrote, that there are other shapes besides this empirical LEE model that provide good fits to the miniboom data. So there is not one shape. And unfortunately, the microboom analysis provided exclusions that were very specific to this shape of this empirical LEE model. So what we tried to do was to translate this neutrino flux at truth level into an event rate for the microboom analysis. And we didn't have enough information from the public data release to, you know, unfortunately, microboom was not like miniboom. Miniboom gives you a very specific recipe to take a truth level oscillation probability and translate that into an event rate. Microboom didn't provide all that information for us to do that. So we had to do some heuristic assumptions and modeling. And this is our best attempt to estimate what will be the event rate from these benchmarks. So let me just explain these plots. So on the left, we have the event rate in the charge current quasi-elastic deep learning signal region. That's one of the microboom analysis. And on the right, we have the wire cell analysis. So another microboom analysis. And in gray, in both of these plots, we have the backgrounds. And in hatched blue and hatched red, we have the expectation from this empirical LEE model that microboom used. And the histograms in green, so light green and dark green, are the predictions that we think are our best estimate for the expectation for these quasi-sterile benchmarks. And as you can see, the event rate is significantly different for the empirical LEE model and for these two quasi-sterile benchmarks. And we cannot calculate a p-value again because we don't have the proper covariance matrix for these models. We didn't get enough information from the public data release. to be able to build this covariance matrix. But at least by eye, you can see that it's if you average it out, the event rate expected from these benchmarks is 50% or less of the empirical LEE model. And so it's possible, I guess it's not a stretch to say that these quasi-sterile benchmarks are not excluded by this microboon analysis at a confidence level that is greater than 95%. They are not favored by the microboon analysis, that's for sure, but maybe one would need more data and better analysis to be able to fully exclude these guys. So that kind of covers all of the content of the paper that we had. So unless there are any more questions, I will just spend the rest of my talk talking about some work in progress on challenges to this quasi-sterile neutrino model that were not addressed in the paper.
So just before you move on, the p-values, yes, we're waiting for more information from microboon, but the code that we used for our curves is on GitHub. So if you want to maybe a slightly better estimate of what the microboon p-values here would be, you can try using that. It's so not official.
Just out of curiosity, how did you, I mean, did you, is it easy to explain in simple terms, how did you get the covariance matrix for a generic model?
Some of that was provided for at least CCQE analysis, the one you see on the left. They provide you with the Monte Carlo.
But not with the covariance matrix. Right?
Not with the covariance, that is true. I think we digitized something from the paper. I can check, but in principle, that figure exists somewhere.
Which figure?
The color map with the covariance matrix.
No, of course, but that's probably, you see, the covariance matrix depends on the model you're testing. So they provide the covariance matrix for the background hypothesis. They provide the covariance matrix for the empirical LEE model hypothesis and different strengths of this LEE model. And they are all different. But if you have another, model.
Actually, I'm not sure. I think if you are able to come up with a prediction for an additional amount of new E's, so let's, because everything here is a phrase in terms of a probability. So if I have a probability for nu mu to nu e, in principle, you can use this covariance. It shouldn't depend on whether it's a template or an oscillation in this case.
Yeah, I disagree because what the covariance matrix is secretly encoding are the correlations between these bins, and different templates will lead to different. So for example, the red template. In the red template, if you have an increase in the second bin, you also give an increase in rate in the first bin. And if your correlation between the bins goes that way as well, then that's good for your model. If it's anti-correlated, that's bad for your model.
No, that's true. So that's why for every prediction that you have, the covariance matrix is going to give you a certain chi-squared in this case.
Right.
So, I mean, whatever prediction it will be, you don't care whether it's coming from oscillations or something else, I don't think. The only thing that I can think of is whether backgrounds that you're using in this fit are changed, which could be the case in your model, like it is for oscillations. For us, we also have nu e disappearance and nu mu disappearance, and those change these plots that you're looking at because they constrain this background.
Yes.
So, I actually think that it would be a very similar exercise to what we've done with the oscillation.
Okay, so maybe I'll take a look at what you... I remember reading our paper and not finding enough information, but you were saying if I go to GitHub, I can get more.
Yeah, there's a V2 coming with more info, but all of the code is already on GitHub already. So, we can discuss more offline as well.
Okay, sounds good. All right, so let me spend the rest of the time I have telling you about challenges to this quasi-sterile neutrino model. And I will discuss the challenges in degree of severity. So the first challenge that you might have noticed already is that we need to have a tuning of the active and quasi-sterile sector mixing to make this model work. So the first obvious tuning is that we need to align the mixing of these quasi-sterile neutrinos and the active neutrinos in the Yukawa basis. Right, so each quasi-sterile neutrino mixes with a mass eigenstate in the standard model. And the second tuning is that we need the shift of all of the three active states from below the resonance to above the resonance to be the same within 5% to preserve the standard model mass spectrum. And in terms of model parameters, this constraint on the shift means a constraint on this combination of psi squared of mixing angles times mass squared splittings. And moreover, in order to be consistent with the long baseline measurements, we need the shifts to be at most an order of magnitude higher than the scale set by the atmospheric mass splitting. So there are all these tunings that need to go on. And in this model, we just invoked these tunings as ad hoc, you know, we did it by hand. But in principle, you could think that maybe you could do some model building work to, instead of having this being a result of tuning, it could be the result of some global symmetry in the Yukawa sector. And I say this because, for example, the mass mixing term of the active and quasi-sterile neutrinos is approximately this quantity. And as you can see, this quantity is just the square root of these combination of model parameters that we're trying to impose to be the same. So maybe some global symmetry arguments in the Yukawa sector could handle this challenge. Now, here's a second challenge that I, for one, don't have an idea of how to make it, how to address it via model building, and that's the Mini-Boone axis coincidence. And this is the fact that there are two mechanisms here at play. We have the resonant oscillations, and we have the non-resonant oscillations, and they are, in principle, totally unrelated, and yet both of them happen to produce a new Newton reoscillation at Mini-Boone in the same window of energy. So how lucky Mini-Boone is, right, that he was able to see those two BSM effects that are unrelated, right? So the resonant mechanism depends on the splitting between the active and quasi-sterile states, and also on the matter potential. The matter potential in turn depends on the mediator mass and couplings and the matter density along Mini-Boone's baseline. And the non-resonant component depends on the vanilla sterile neutrino that has nothing to do with these guys and its mixing angle and mass splittings with the active neutrino. So why these two things should appear right on top of each other at Mini-Boone is an obvious coincidence that I think is a flaw of this model. But still, you would be willing to overlook this flaw, but then there is a third challenge that I think is even more significant to this model. And I just want you to keep in mind, this is work in progress. So everything that I'm going to say here might change as we understand better what's going on here. And also, if you have ideas and you disagree with what I'm going to say, please chime in. So let me go a little slow here on the case of solar neutrinos. So neutrinos are produced at the solar core, and then they propagate through the solar medium towards the surface to exit the sun and be measured at the Earth. And so as they are propagating through the solar medium, they are experiencing a varying medium density. And this is expressed here, on this cartoon plot on the horizontal axis by the inverse of the medium density in the sun as a function of R, okay? And this is neutrino energy on the vertical axis. And so the question is, what is the resonant energy in the solar medium? And this resonant energy, of course, changes depending on the density of the medium. And it's given by this green curve here. So in particular, at the solar core, the resonant energy is in this range of 2.5 to 6.5 MeV. And of course, this range is not certain because it depends on a few things. First, it depends on the mediator couplings to electrons, protons, neutrons, and the combination of them. And because the solar core composition in terms of electrons, protons, and neutrons is different than in the Earth, this thing can vary depending on what you choose for the mediator couplings. And it also, there is some variation here because we don't know exactly what is the density of the medium as neutrinos propagate in the Mini-Boone baseline. So there is also that uncertainty. But anyways, it is within this energy range, which is right where the solar neutrinos are measured.
How much is it different? The density is much higher than on the Earth, but the relative, like the number of electrons and protons is obviously the same. And then just the neutrons that are there in helium are a little bit more abundant, is it, than in the Earth?
No, neutrons are a little less abundant because on the Earth, I guess in the Earth, it's you know, if you're very coarse, you can say that the number of protons and neutrons are the same. Yeah. Now, in the solar core, you have a lot more, you have a greater relative composition of hydrogen versus helium. So the relative composition
helium
of...
Helium is enhanced in the core, right? So you have more helium.
Yes, but you don't have 100% helium. I think you have like 60 something percent helium and 30 something percent hydrogen.
More neutrons in the Earth. That's the thing.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that's right. More neutrons in the Earth. Yes. Right. If you were electrons, then you wouldn't have to worry about this. But once you start bringing protons and neutrons, then you do worry. Yeah. Okay. All right, so it's within this range, but that's not the most important point I want to make here. So one more comment about this. So this line defines a boundary. So in this region of parameter space, you're above the resonance, and below this line, you are below the resonance in the sun, okay? Now, another picture that I want you to keep in mind are the propagation eigenstates and their eigenvalues. And this is for this quasi-sterile neutrino model. Now, this is too complicated. It has too many moving parts, and most of them don't really matter for the argument that I want to make. So I'll just simplify this picture significantly just to keep things, you know, in perspective. So just think of this as a pictorial depiction of the active and quasi-sterile sectors. So the active sector is represented by this blue shade. So this is active flavor, and the gray shade is the quasi-sterile flavor. And in general, you have this two type of propagation eigenstates that flip their identity as you cross the resonant region. And I also changed this axis here. Before, it was neutrino energy. Now I'm giving you neutrino energy in units of the resonant energy in the sun for a particular solar radius, okay? All right, so let's see what happens with neutrinos now. If you produce a neutrino in the solar core that is below the resonant energy, this neutrino will propagate outside of the solar core towards the surface. And if you look at this picture, what's happening is the neutrino is produced below the resonance, as you can see here. Its identity is a flavor, eigenstate that is active, right? Because it's produced by weak interactions. And as it propagates towards the surface, it's going in this direction. So it's produced as an active neutrino. It stays as an active neutrino. Nothing really changes there. It's just experiencing the MSW effect. And so this neutrino is fine. Now, what's not fine are the neutrinos that are produced above the resonant energy. So they are produced above the resonant energy, they propagate from the solar core towards outside, and at some point they cross this resonant boundary and they go from above the resonance to below the resonance. And in this picture, what's happening with this neutrino, it's produced above the resonance as an active state. It crosses the resonance, and then as it goes below the resonance, it completely changes its flavor composition to be a quasi-sterile state, okay? So of course, this argument that I'm making depends on adiabaticity and coherence being preserved during all of this neutrino propagation through the solar medium. But if these two conditions of adiabaticity and coherence hold, then the natural conclusion is that all of the active neutrinos that are produced with an energy above the resonant energy in the solar core will convert into quasi-sterile neutrinos. And this is obviously very problematic. So this doesn't work. So now the question that we asked is there any possible mechanism that might be coming into place to avoid the scenario? And one of the things that you can do is try to remove this condition of coherence, right? So if the quasi-sterile neutrino coupling to the solar medium via this vector mediator is strong enough, you can try to conceive the possibility that maybe the quasi-sterile neutrino has a short mean free path within the dense solar medium. And if that's the case, then you can try to invoke the coherence. So in this case, what you would have is the state that is produced above the resonance as an active flavor state, it's coherent. But as it crosses the resonant region, so it's within the resonant region now, and it develops a significant quasi-sterile component because now you have maximal mixing. And once you have a significant quasi-sterile component, it will scatter if the mean free path of this quasi-sterile component is short. And if it scatters, then you go from a coherent state to a mixed state. So it becomes, very heuristically, and this is something we have to check, but it can possibly become a mixed state that is 50% the heavy propagation eigenstate and 50% the light propagation eigenstate. And then this mixed state, as it exits the resonant region to go below the resonance, it becomes this mixed state that is 50% quasi-sterile neutrino, 50% active neutrino. So this component,
I have a question. So when you say it starts scattering more actively, this is no longer forward scattering, you mean? Like it starts bouncing around, right?
Yes, exactly. So starts bouncing around and then it loses coherence, yeah.
Yeah, and also loses energy if it bounces many times.
Exactly. So again, you have to find a model where within the resonant region, you won't bounce many times. It will bounce once or twice. And then as it exits the resonant region, then this guy will continue to bounce. So it will scatter and terminalize. But then this guy that converted almost 100% into active will continue to evolve without bouncing. And it will evolve just under the standard MSW effect. Did I answer it?
Naive question. Here you're worried that your normal neutrino signal gets distorted, right?
But it gets disappeared, it disappears completely, yes.
You're also producing quite a bit of dark states that have interactions with nuclei that are significantly larger than G Fermi. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So then
my expectation is that these states...
Xenon one ton as well, because this this is already at the borderline of boron 8, so you should be cognizant of that.
Right? Yes, so I don't know if you disagree with me, but then my expectation is that these... So you lose half of the flux, right? You start with an active neutrino at the solar core, and then half of these flux stays as active neutrino, the other half becomes this quasi-sterile state. But my expectation, at least naively, and I may be totally wrong, is that because they continue to scatter significantly and lose energy in the sun, they thermalize. So they're no longer high energy and they will no longer pop up in xenon one ton as a significant axis. Do you disagree?
Okay, no, that was, you said one or two times, but okay, this is in the resonant region, then you have further energy degradation in the outer region.
Right.
Yeah,
and the resonant region, remember, it's very narrow, right? Because this region where you have maximal mixing, especially at low mixing angles,
so just for narrow. Me to understand, what is the relative strength of this interaction relative to G Fermi in the forward scattering? You have a sterile neutrino that is a fermion. You have a neutrino proton that is a fermion.
Yeah.
Stern model gives you G Fermi times whatever weak charge, one half for the neutron and so on.
Yeah. I don't think you can make this. So forward scattering is, it's a zero momentum transfer. So you have coupling squared over mass of the mediator squared.
But you obviously have put in some benchmark models and so on. So what is your coupling squared divided by the mass of the mediator squared compared to G Fermi? That's what I'm interested in.
I think it's, I have to go back and look, Maxim. I don't remember, but I think it's...
Does it matter?
I possibly agree that this is larger than G Fermi, right?
Yeah. But again, remember, you can have a very small coupling over a very small mass.
Order of magnitude, two orders of magnitude, three orders of magnitude, because it matters.
Yeah, it's potentially larger, but again, it's two things. So when you have forward scattering, what matters is coupling squared over mass of the mediator squared. And when you have non-forward scattering or exchange momentum, if the mediator is light, then you have coupling squared over... Yes.
I understand. But still, so your mediator mass, you're thinking also not in MEV, capital MEV, or lighter than that?
Lighter, lighter. Not maybe not significantly lighter, but lighter. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
I mean, and just to understand, you can know what the interaction strength because you are setting your potential such that you're on the resonance at 200 MeV, right?
At 300 MeV, a minimum, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so two times in U times this potential, that sets the G Fermi of your theory. Okay, cool.
Yeah, and I think Maxime is right. If I go back and I look at my notes, yes, this forward scattering potential is greater for this particular BSM mediator than for weak interactions. Anyways. So, okay, but my point here is if you have this effect of decoherence and you just happen to be lucky to find a mediator that makes this work, then your active neutrinos above the resonant region, they lose half of their flux, right? Once they pass through the resonant region and go outside. So half of their flux gets lost into quasi-sterols, but at least you get to keep half. And these continue to evolve under the standard matter effects in the sun, the MSW effect, but with an altered solar mass plane, because remember, the active mass spectrum close to this BSM resonant region is significantly distorted. So delta M squared 2-1 is significantly distorted in this case. So let me show you one benchmark that may work here. So this is a plot that I borrowed from a talk online. My model was not here yet. Okay, so this is just neutrino energy and the electron neutrino probability from the sun. And it's a very busy plot. It has these two lines, dark blue and dark green. And they are just the standard MSW effect prediction that you expect for the electron probability for two choices of the solar mass bleeding. Okay. And then you have these data points from Bruxino and Super K and Snow and Homestake and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, this is one potential benchmark where you have the following. First, you have, forget about this issue of the decoherence and the loss of flux. You have the shape of this MSW curve being altered because now you significantly change the effective delta M squared to one. And so the curve looks like this. But like I mentioned, for neutrinos that are produced at high energies above the resonant energy at the core, and here in this case, I chose the resonant energy at the core to be 4 MeV, you lose half of this flux, okay? And so you get close to 60% electron neutrino probability at low energies, below 4 MeV-ish, and above 4 MeV-ish, you get approximately half of that. And so in principle, you can, you know, maybe be consistent with the solar neutrino data with this model. So that's one aspect of this, but this doesn't solve the entire problem. So there is one last problem that I want to mention, which is Snow didn't just look at the neutrino flux of electron neutrinos from the sun. They also looked at these reactions that is neutral current scattering, where solar neutrinos scatter on deuterium and they break it apart to a neutron and proton. And so this particular signal is sensitive to all of the active neutrino flavors. And so once they combine this measurement here given in blue on this plot with their measurements with charge current scattering and electron scattering, they were able to determine within this certainty what was the electron flux and the non-electron flux of neutrinos from the sun, okay? And obviously, because we have this loss of solar neutrino flux, because half of them are converting to quasi-sterile neutrinos, this is not what we expect from this quasi-sterile neutrino model. Instead, the expectation here should be closer to this point here, okay? And obviously, this is very outside the region favored by the Snow measurements, so this is excluded. Okay, so now here we go again. Is there another effect that could potentially avoid the scenario? And so you could consider the possibility, as was mentioned before, that the active neutrinos, due to their tiny little mixing with the quasi-sterols, they will also have a tiny coupling with this dark mediator that is responsible for the matter potential. And so through this dark mediator, you could have a contribution to this neutral current scattering that could break deuterium apart.
Sorry. Why you just explained to me that all these dark states will be thermalized and will lose energy? How is it
This is not a dark state. This is an active neutrino.
Oh, it's an active neutrino. Thank you.
Yeah. And this is an active neutrino that exited the sun, made it to the Earth, and now it needs to scatter on snow to break apart deuterium to give you enough rate to explain the rate that snow observed.
By the way, the standard model neutron current cross-section is much larger than 10 minus 45, much larger.
No, not for this energy range. This energy range of order MeV, it's 10 to the minus 45.
Well, order MeV, it cannot happen. It has to be above 2.2 MeV, right?
Yes, I mean order MeV, sorry. Yes, above 2.2 MeV.
No, it's right at the threshold. It's quite significant already, I think. Well, it depends very much how you couple your A dark. If it couples to spins, then it's large. If it couples to baryon number, it's very small.
Okay, there is the standard model cross-section, and I'm not clear whether you're disagreeing with me that it's this size for this particular reaction. And
no,
then there is
larger,
whatever...
Larger. Yes. Otherwise, you would never... I hear what you're saying, that it's because of the 10 MeV neutrinos. I doubt. I think it's quite larger all the way to the threshold.
What do you mean? The threshold is 2.2 MeV.
Yes.
To break apart the deuterium.
So it actually quite a bit larger than 10 minus 45.
Well, the papers, so I'm going to mention in the next slide that this reaction was measured with reactor antineutrinos. And
rather precisely calculable, that reaction.
Yes, and in these papers that I looked up, this is I made a huge mistake when I read off the cross-section from the paper. This is what they had.
That was the whole point of the snow experiment, that the cross-sections are much larger than 10 minus 45.
Are you saying that this reactor...
The number I have in mind is 10 minus 42.
I think 10 minus 42 sounds right, actually.
10 minus 42, that's the benchmark for the cross section. But
okay.
I'm trying to say that in standard model, the cross section is based on the difference between the axial vector coupling between neutron and proton and the excitation of the deuterium into deuterium star. That is may not be the case if you couple to vector current. Well, it will not be the case.
You surely can have photo disintegration of deuterium, right? So
yeah,
that means a vector
coupled. You will get additional suppression by the mass of the neutron and proton. So it will be additionally suppressed by, you know, frequency over the mass, which is like 10 minus 3 to a good power. I do not know at what stage of this calculation you are, but yeah, by the way, I have calculated something like that like 11 years ago, but for a specific model, for a vector coupling to the same coupling to neutron and proton. And then there it's suppressed.
Okay. Well, let me make two comments. Going back to the standard model process, right, which is weak interactions, that cross-section grows with energy linearly. So it's possible that this number that you have, that is 10 to the minus 42 instead of 45, is for this cross-section when the neutrino energy is GeV, tens of
No, 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 for the solar energies. What I meant is that, for the boron 8 neutrinos scattering on deuterium have cross sections much, much larger than 10 to minus 45 centimeters squared. I cannot pin exact number now. Is it 10 minus 42 or is 10 minus 43? But it's not for the GeV neutrinos.
I mean, I know for sure that at 1 GeV, it's 10 minus 38. So if it's linear with energy, maybe you pay another penalty because
it's
close
to threshold.
Yeah,
if it's 10 to the minus 38, then you're right. It's three orders of magnitude down. You know for sure this particular reaction.
10 minus 45. is a benchmark cross-section for a scattering of an elastic scattering on electrons of the solar neutrinos. But the scattering on nucleons is orders of magnitude larger. That's the whole point of the Snow experiment. If this were 10 to minus 45 centimeters squared, there would have been no Snow experiment possible whatsoever.
Okay, so I will go back and look at the papers from where I retrieved this number, and maybe I didn't look correctly, and you might be correct, but I have to go back and look at the references that I use for this. But okay, in any case, then I'd have to correct this this value to be 10 to the minus 42, as you mentioned.
That might work for you. Adjust everything. Favor, right? Because you need a larger cross section, right? I mean, like, you, I don't know.
I think it goes in the right direction. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but in any case, if I just write how much I need in terms of the standard model cross section, whatever it is, it's in the range of between 30% to 100% if I want to bring this black dot from very much outside of this blob to within the 95% confidence level blob. So 30% at least to get within 95% confidence level of the Snow determination. Okay, so now how likely is it that I can do that? How viable is this? Again, this is work in progress, so I cannot give you a definitive answer. But again, I need to find a dark mediator completion that is consistent to do everything that I needed to do. Besides doing this, it also needs to have that short mean free path in the sun. It also needs to have the right matter potential to explain mini boons. So these are a lot of requirements that one needs. And we're still not clear whether we have a completion that gives you all of this. And then this number needs to be revised. But like I said, whatever this number is, it will be in the tens to hundreds of percent of the standard model cross section only within this energy range that is at 10 MeV or less. So here is where we have to worry about this. As you go to higher energies, the standard model cross section increases linearly with energy. So at the GeV or higher neutrino energies, this becomes a sub-percent effect, so we don't have to worry on that regime. Now, in this low energy regime, and that's what I was trying to say, Maxime, as far as I understand, there were reactor measurements of this cross-section, so anti-electron neutrino breaking apart deuterium, and this was measured by these experiments, Savannah, River, Rovno, Krasnoyarsk.
This process has been calculated through whatever ab initio process is to a percent rate accuracy, it's possible.
Yes, okay, it was calculated and it was also measured. And my understanding from these papers is that the calculation and the measurement agree, except that the precision of these experiments is within 20%. Yeah. So as far as experimental verification of this cross-section, the only one that I could find was this, and that's where I got this value. But again, maybe I didn't really care for it, but whatever, I'll go back and look. You also have sevens, right?
I'll try to find the real time. Go on.
Okay.
Try to find.
Okay. I appreciate it if you do. And you, of course, in principle, you also have coherent elastic neutrino nucleus scattering that could also probe this regime and see if you have a significant contribution of order of the standard model contribution. But my understanding is that seven sensitivity is not competitive yet. It might get there in the future, but it's not there yet. And so, okay, my broad conclusion from this, if I'm going to be honest, is that you still have this tension with the Snow measurements, although now I have to revise this cross-section. And so I don't think it's likely that I'll find a viable model that has all of these requirements and avoids all of these issues that I mentioned. So the takeaway from this exercise, given the challenges that I presented to this model, is I think the viability of this quasi-sterile neutrino in explaining the mini-boon low energy axis is not great. These are significant obstacles that I think put into question whether this model is excluded. However, at least for me, there was a good takeaway from all of this exercise, which is if you take this very generic consequence of light-dark sectors, which is this combination of neutrino and vector portals, Then you have a very generic expectation of these BSM matter effects. And these can be non-trivially constrained by data. One, because they significantly distort the active neutrino mixing and mass spectrum, even if you're very, very far away from the resonant region, like I mentioned. And also, if you're trying to play with new matter effects, solar neutrinos might be a very easy way to kill your model. So that was everything I had prepared for my talk. So thanks for your attention, and I'm happy to answer more questions if you have any.
All right. Thank you so much, Daniele. Very interesting talk. I'll just ask if there are any urgent questions for the recording. Otherwise, we can stop it here.
So the benchmark cross-section for the 10 MeV neutrino is 10 minus 42 centimeters squared.
And you're looking up some reference?
Yeah.
I'll okay, can you send me?
Right away in the chat.
Ah, okay.
So table one on page 17.
Give me a second, let me get to page 17.
I guess you were right on threshold, because right on threshold you have...
Well, right on threshold is small, yes. I'm not saying it's not going to work whatsoever. I'm just saying don't say 10 minus 45 centimeters squared, where it's much better benchmark is 10 minus 42.
Okay, now I have to go back and reconcile that with the reactor papers that I was looking at. I'm pretty sure I saw 10 to minus 45, but I'll look it again. Yeah.
It may be neutrino electron scattering. Yeah. Because then you were always three orders of magnitude.
No, it was reaction. It was a deuteron disintegration with reactor neutrinos. So it was exactly that reaction.
Interesting.
Well, for 3 MeV, you're right. If you look at this table, it's very close to threshold. You're right. It's 3 times 10 minus 45. 45 and then, but then
I see
we got 10, it's already right. 1. Yeah,
okay, I see. So, okay, now these things are consistent. Yeah, you're right. Okay, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks, Maxime. I'm glad you were in the talk and pointed that out to me.
No worries. But right. Also, look, like in the BSM, like I said, I did the calculation a long time ago for the vector portal.
Okay. I'll look it up. So do you have any, keywords that I can use to look up this?
I'll just send you another thing in the chat.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I write too many papers.
So kind of silly question, but so your equation there is saying it has to be order neutral current times 30%, like basically 30% of neutral current. Is that the requirement or is the numerical requirement what you need?
No, that's the requirement to bring, you see, this is just based on loss of flux. That's where this black dot lands. Mm-hmm. For that naive argument that I gave you. So if we want to move this black dot inside the 2 sigma region, we need to boost this contribution by 30%.
Okay, so it's relative to neutral current. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So then how about coherent then?
Right. So coherent is, yes, like I mentioned, I guess I have an asterisk here. Coherent, and there's also, there's a reactor experiment
Dresden
that also met
2 or something like that.
It's actually based in Brazil, but I forget, CONI or something.
Oh, CONI. There's also CONI, right. Yes.
So they also put some constraints on this type of couplings via coherent elastic neutrino nucleus scattering. But I think that's still for CONUS is almost 2 orders of magnitude the size of the standard model cross-section, and coherent is a few times the size of the standard model cross-section. Whereas these reactor experiments, although now Maxime pointed out to me that's only at 3 MeV, it's 20% precision. So I just assumed that the reactors were more precise. But yeah, sevens will get there, I guess.
Yeah, that is it. Because I remember people talk about this, what they call LMA dark solution. And then one of the biggest deals of this coherent for people that cared about NSIs was that it kills the LMA dark solution, which is in a kind of similar to your scenario. You have some enhancement to the matter potential.
Right.
So I would expect them to be very sensitive to this kind of stuff, but it does depend on your mediator and your model, I guess. So if you had something that only talked to leptons, I think your life may be easier on the mini-boon side. I'm not sure you could do...
True, but then we have this problem, right? Then the model gets killed because of this, because you just don't get enough neutral current scattering that's no measured because of this loss of of neutrinos, active neutrinos. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I see Maxime. Great, thank you, Maxime. I appreciate the other reference, so I'll look it up.
It's something very similar. Back in the day, I tried to oscillate solar neutrinos into some new species of neutrinos and make them interact more with the matter, not less. So similar in spirit.
Okay, great. Yes, wonderful. Take a look.
All right, I will stop recording here unless there are any other urgent questions. All right, thanks, Daniele.